I think what I would say is that it's a kind of full sensory experience of being separate from the body at a remote location. I think the key factor, maybe for me, is the degree to which the depth of the experience has gone. So, for example, with remote viewing or various other kinds of psi experiences, I think the full immersion in the experience, if you like, the degree to which you are aware completely at the other location is on a different level. For example, in remote viewing, there's a sense of being aware of another location, but there's also the awareness of being in the room, doing the action that you're doing, following the protocol. There's a kind of double awareness going on usually in that kind of context. Then that can move up to maybe what I would describe as something like a semi out-of-body experience, where there's a sort of twin awareness where you're aware of both your body and being out of the body, but it's much more intense than would be experienced in a remote viewing. And then there's what I would describe as a full out-of-body experience, which is where there is no awareness of the body or almost completely no awareness of the body, and a sense of moving through space, often fully identifying with the separate self, the energy body or the second self, whatever you want to call it. And your physical body might seem almost alien, not necessarily even related to you. For example, my first out-of-body experience I ever had, my body seemed quite alien. It didn't seem like me at all. I only knew that it was me because it was in my bed and it had the same appearance as me. So there was this kind of complete disconnect, if you like, between the physical body and the self, the consciousness that was separate.
One thing that occurs to me while you're talking about this is that you're dealing with intensity as a major factor or a major component of whether you define something as an out-of-body experience or not. In my case, I actually look at veridicality. So if I actually find that I can verify something that's happened remotely, I actually worry a lot less about the intensity than I do about the verticality. In fact, I have many experiences that I do think are out-of-body experiences that are quite intense, but they are not, and they match the kind of descriptions you're talking about as being full out-of-body experience, but they're not vertical. And for that reason, I tend to downplay those as out-of-body experiences, and instead I talk more about the ones that are vertical. How does that play into your own experience with these kinds of things? Do you feel that I've made a legitimate call there by saying, well, if it's vertical, it's an out-of-body experience, even if it's not intense? Because that maybe is just how well I remember it, as opposed to whether it really.
Well, I think the veridicality is a big factor for me, for sure. I would definitely go along with that, but I don't think it's the whole defining feature for me with what I would categorize it as. Because I suppose if you think an out-of-body experience, if you just take it in terms of the terms that we're using, I think it's what you experience as an individual. For example, in some near-death experiences, there's definitely a sense that this was an out-of-body experience, but there might not be a veridical factor. Or for example, some of the descriptions in Robert Munro's work, for example, where there wasn't something that he could have verified in any particular way, but he was very, very, adamant that that was a full out-of-body experience. So I think there's shades and levels, like I said, but I think that the veridical factor definitely makes it very, very certain that what was going on was an out-of-body experience.
You've told me that in the past, your out-of-body experiences, at least some of them anyway, happen while you're essentially fully conscious. Could you describe one of those, what those are like?
My out-of-body experience is probably in the region of 98% are from the hypnagogic or semi-waking state. They happen before sleep, and the experience will end before I go into sleep. So it's usually that kind of time before I go to sleep. So I'll lay down, I'll start to experience usually a sense of heightened energy, maybe a sense of space or expanse beyond my eyes. And then that's usually followed by maybe not a classic vibrational state that you generally hear about, but more of a kind of wave sensation, a sort of energy pattern that goes through my body. When I get that, I know that the conditions are right, if you like. And then if I focus my awareness externally with my eyes closed still, maybe on a point on the ceiling or something, I'll usually go into an out-of-body experience. Or I'll go into what I call the void state, which is a sort of black state where I'm aware of sort of darkness or just blackness, but I'm not really conscious of anything else. I'm not having any thoughts as such, but I'm not asleep. It's this kind of in-between state. And then that will usually move into starting to get impressions and sensory awareness of a remote location. And then that will blossom, if you like, into the full sensory awareness of being at another location. So that's one example. But I've also had experiences where I've literally been walking down the stairs, come into another room, and I've started to sense energy within the room, and I've actually sensed it from a fully conscious walking around type state. And then I've thought, there's something activating here, and then I've sat down or laid down at that point. So it can actually even come about from a fully conscious state, but that's very rare.
Okay, but when that happens, it sounds to me like in both cases you get a kind of a key or a signal of some kind that makes you aware of the possibility of a out-of-body experience occurring, and then you transition to an out-of-body experience. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, now the thing that I wonder about when you say it that way is that then when you're in the out-of-body experience, presumably your physical body is in some kind of stasis that I would imagine would resemble sleep, would it not?
From descriptions I've had from people who've been around me, it doesn't have the features of sleep. It maybe looks more like a deep relaxation or...
How would you know the difference?
Well, obviously it's quite subjective, but I think that when someone's asleep, they usually, maybe their breathing is not in the same sense as if they were awake or just laying relaxed. There's things like rapid eye movement often. From observations with my people in the past, there's the not been rapid eye movement in my experience. So different elements like that. I mean, you can't say conclusively, but it seems like a slightly different state to full sleep.
Okay, well, now I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to say what my experience is of this. It's going to differ a bit from yours. For me, I have sometimes felt that vibrational effect that you spoke of and we're both familiar with from Robert Monroe's books. Although, to be quite frank about it, sometimes when I feel that, I wonder, is this my imagination or is this real? I do feel like these waves of vibrations passing through my body. It's almost like being electrocuted.
Well, I should point out that I think there's different understandings of the vibrational state. In my second book, I looked into quite a lot of the descriptions and found that actually people seem to be describing something quite different in certain contexts.
Is what I just described different from what you experienced?
My experience is more like a wave, as I said. It's more of a rhythmic, sort of quite not intense, whereas, for example, what Robert Monroe described at certain times, it sounded like he was almost saying it was a violent experience, like quite an aggressive amount of energy. And I've only ever experienced that kind of thing once, which was my first ever OBE, essentially.
Okay, well, in my case, I felt it sometimes, and it has preceded what I would describe as an out-of-body dream or an out-of-body experience that occasionally, but not always, is veridical. And when it is, then it makes me feel comfortable that it's a true out-of-body experience. So, for instance, I might feel that sensation as I'm going to sleep, which is exactly the same as you were just saying, actually, in the pre-sleep state. And then, while I'm still conscious, I transition into an awareness that my body's asleep and I'm out of my body. And then I have this desire to see someone. I have no idea where the desire comes from, but I'll just want to see a certain person and I'll go there, or someone will appear near me like a spirit guide and take me somewhere else and I'll go there. And then I'll generally have a blank period that ends when I'm at the other location and I witness something there, and then I come back and wake up and I write down my dream. I've kind of skipped over a couple of things there purposely, though, because I wanted to focus on the fact that up until the point of transitioning from having the sensation of physically of something happening, like the wave or the electrical sensation I was talking about, and then entering an out-of-body experience, it sounds like it's fairly similar, okay? But then it starts getting a lot different, because I've got plenty of these out-of-body experiences that are not preceded by any sensation like that at all. They have nothing to do with when I'm going to sleep, but when I'm waking up, or something, sometimes like in the middle of the night, it's really hard to say whether it was just as I fell asleep or when I woke up. But in any event, I will come back with a powerful sense of having been out of my body, and a powerful sense of having visited someone while out of body, and I will be able to check with that person and find out that indeed the things that I saw were valid for that person at approximately that time. But one thing that I have found kind of interesting about some of these is that there is some offset in time. I mean, occasionally it's simultaneous, but at other times I seem to have witnessed something that was real, but that happened to the person a day or two prior to the out-of-body experience. Have you ever run into something like that, where you've actually seen something that was veridical, but it wasn't from the time that you were actually having the experience?
Oh, yeah, sure. I think actually my most powerful out-of-body experiences ever really have been ones that have been precognitive in some sense. So the classic one in my experiences was when I was doing a small group where there was five of us in total, and I was teaching the G technique, which I just developed at the time, which is one of the techniques I use. And during that process, I basically went into this intense trance state. The next thing I was aware of was moving through a natural environment, and then that environment broke, and I seemed to be in a standing on the corner of Old Compton Street in Soho in central London, and I watched an explosion and a terrorist attack happen in London. Then this kind of wave of emotion hit me, and I was aware of being back in my body, but I was still in this kind of void state again, this sort of blackness, but not conscious, not unconscious, somewhere in between. And one of the other people who was there, a guy called Chris, started to coax me out of the experience gradually. And then when I came out of it, I said I'd seen this thing that I felt was precognitive from the start, and described this explosion and whatever. And then 5 days later, there was an explosion on that street in the same context that I'd seen it.
Well, let me ask you, how do you differentiate something like that? Or why is it that you define it as an out-of-body experience that was precognitive as opposed to a precognitive dream or a premonition?
Well, I suppose I wouldn't define it as a dream because it didn't have any of the features of a dream that I understand. It felt like I was physically floating and then physically there standing on that corner. The only difference to maybe physical reality was that I had a kind of bluish grey tinge to my vision. And actually it was almost more real than physical reality. I suppose the other factor was I hadn't gone to sleep. There was none of the psychological overlay that I usually experience with dreams. So I suppose if I look at all the points that I would define in terms of how my dream reality is, I think it was quite distinct from that.
If I were to use the same criteria that it seems like you're using right there, many of the precognitive dreams, or the things that I classify only as precognitive, are also out-of-body experiences, because in them I feel quite certain I'm there physically, I'm aware that it's in the future. It turns out it really was in the future, because later on I'm able to verify it somehow. And I may even have some of the other factors associated with out-of-body experiences. Do you think, based on what I just said, that you would count those precognitive experiences as out-of-body as well?
It's very hard to know without, I think the problem we always have with any definition, it can tie itself in knots in a sense, because once you really try to pick it up apart and say, well, what exactly were you experiencing?
If I fall asleep right now or have an out-of-body experience right now, it's 3:29 p.m. November 17th, 2012, and then I see something somewhere else that's happening at roughly that same time, I count that as an out-of-body experience. But if, on the other hand, I see something that I can verify tomorrow because that's when it happens, that's not simultaneous with what my body is doing. And so I count that as not an out-of-body experience. Does that not make sense to you?
Not hugely, I must admit. I think for me, it's more of a statement on maybe the factors of the experience. But I think when we break it down and just say an out-of-body experience, it's an out-of-body experience is an experience of being out of the body.
Right, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and I think our whole idea of how time operates and all of that kind of thing, I think is still in its infancy, really. I think we're still learning and understanding what might be going on there. So I think to discount it on the basis of linear time, I don't know, I wouldn't feel comfortable with that.
Clearly, if precognition exists, then linear time can't exist, at least not in the way we think of it. So why wouldn't we be able to go to different periods of time when out of the body? But my issue is that the term out of body, just as the term precognition, belongs to our physical experience. It doesn't belong to our non-physical experience. At least that's how I look at it. And so from a physical point of view, I see these things as being very different. Because if I was going to look at it from the other point of view, from the non-physical point of view, let's call that the real point of view, and this is the more fake one, or the illusion. It seems to me that at that point, you wouldn't be able to differentiate an out-of-body experience from any kind of psi experience. Because it seems to me that the natural state of our spirit, and I hope you don't mind my describing it that way, is that it is simultaneously aware of many things. It is capable of simultaneous movement to different locations. It's capable of many, many things, and they are just a natural fact of the properties of this aspect of ourselves. And so at that point, distinguishing one thing as precognitive or out of body or view of the past or the future or psychokinesis or whatever, all of those things are no longer differentiable. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yeah. I think to some degree, the only reason we do differentiate is for the sake of language and for the sake of exploring these kinds of issues from our physical perspective. But I suppose I do tend to take the position of the physical first. I don't have this idea that it's necessarily illusion or anything like that. I see it from the position of, this is my primary experience of the world. This is where I've learned and gained all of these other insights along the way. So I do tend to feel that starting from the physical perspective is maybe the safest or most grounded way that I can work.
You know, since you're saying that, I want to take issue with the term out of body, because it seems to me that it is a shift of mental focus. It is, instead of focusing on your body, you are focusing on something else that is external to your body and its physical location. Although sometimes if you're out of your body and looking at your body, your shift isn't all that great. But this shift of mental focus isn't necessarily literally being out of body. It could be that your focus, or the center of your focus, is outside of your body at all times, but that when you're paying attention to your body, it seems to be coming through your body, because at that time you're looking through your body, kind of like looking at the world through a remote video camera, but then you turn that one off and you go to another one. Does this make sense according to your view?
It does, but I suppose I remain neutral about what the mechanics of what might actually be going on. In my book, I describe the idea of maybe that there's some kind of energy body, but then I also look at the ideas of entanglement, the idea of non-locality in terms of biological non-locality. So this idea that the brain might be entangled in some way, and maybe that's how information is acquired a distance, maybe something like Michael Persinger's idea of the field around the Earth, the geomagnetic field containing all the information that's ever been, something along those lines. So there's lots of ideas that could apply to what's going on, and it could be that consciousness is not in the brain, it's an external thing. And as many near-death experience researchers describe, like Pim van Lommel, Penny Sartori, etc., they see this idea that maybe the brain is like a receiver, like almost like a television receiving a signal. That all is a possibility to me, and I take all of that on. But I guess that I don't know which of those is correct, or if it's actually something completely different.
I'm kind of curious how you feel about the kind of religious or spiritual aspects of it, because I mean, you have to be familiar with all these stories of yogis and monks and lamas who, it sounds like, are having out-of-body experiences all the time. And they associate very spiritual or religious connotations to these kinds of activities. And they, of course, would very much disagree that your brain is making all this stuff up. How do you feel about that, while remaining neutral?
Okay, there was a lot in there. We've gone from quantum physics to spirituality, so I'll try and backtrack a little bit. I see a distinct difference between the religious and the spiritual. And I
actually, just to clarify that right now, because I think we're probably going to agree on this, I frequently use the word religious when I mean what other people would understand as spiritual. So let's just forget about dogma. I'm just talking about something of the spirit related to the spirit, and whether or not people have created religions around it is irrelevant. Is that fair enough?
Sure, yeah. I still think there's a slight difference that I want to flesh out a little bit, because I think for me, there's this idea that whether humans, for example, are developing this kind of understanding, and as we develop this understanding more and we explore moral issues and the greater realities, if you like, whatever they might be, that becomes more of an idea of spirituality. I think my own spirituality, which I do think is very key to what I do, has come out of this sense of interconnection, this sense of an awareness beyond just who I am as an individual person living my life day to day. So there's a spirituality drawn out of that, that's grown out of that, but it's more, if you like, the way I look at it, is more of a bottom-up process, whereas there are other conceptions of spirituality where there already exists a kind of spiritual hierarchy that is then influencing physical reality. That's another way of looking at this idea of spirituality. They both can exist outside of a religious context, but they're, one's a top-down and one's a bottom-up kind of idea, if you like.
Let me give you an example, just for the sake of it. I'm going to say three kind of generic out-of-body experiences as examples. One where there's no external entity present whatsoever, but it's a very vivid experience with no vertical quality at all. Then you have one that's less vivid, but it is vertical. And then you have one that's just as vivid, and it includes these spirit beings and the whole idea that there's this, shall we say, a higher level of responsibility or obligation to the people around us or the spirits around us to help them out, and that my position hierarchically in this scheme of things requires me to help people out, and I'll be brought to certain places for this to happen. So I'd like to know how you feel about the legitimacy of these and how you would classify them relative to your own out-of-body experience, and whether you've had those kind of same groups of experiences yourself.
I wouldn't have a problem with seeing them as legitimate. I think all experiences are essentially legitimate experiences. It's just, I suppose, you made certain conclusions from the one with the spirit guides, for example, that there's this hierarchy and that you have certain obligations, I think was your words. I suppose if I had the same experience, I wouldn't necessarily consider that that's evidence that there is a hierarchy or that I was obligated to do that. I wouldn't necessarily be convinced that those beings were external to me, but I wouldn't discount that possibility either. So that's kind of where I'm at with the whole spirit guide thing. I have experienced, there's two distinct guides, you could say, in my own experiences that have been there for quite a few years now. They're not common in my out-of-body experiences. They happen more in other work that I do. I also do this kind of more trance-based work that I do in a very conscious way, and I almost go into a trance and connect with that kind of thing. And I pick up that information more when I do that process. But I'm still in a sort of situation where I don't know whether those things are a factor of my own psychology, there's some aspect of myself, or whether they are independently existing beings on another level. At the moment, I'm not ready to commit to what I think is going on there.
When you say you're not convinced or you're not ready to admit that they're independent.
Commit,
fine. I'd like to explore that just a little bit. I mean, in my experience, they've actually done things that indicate to me that they definitely are independent. Like, for instance, I'll disagree with them, they'll correct me, they'll give me information that's veridical, that it goes completely against my opinions on things. And in my mind, those are all expressions of independence. They also seem to be more knowledgeable than I am, and they seem to be directing things, and I'm more passive. They seem to have almost a goal of teaching me often things and putting me in situations where I'm able to learn. All of these qualities make me think of them as independent. Now, I would imagine you've had similar experiences yourself, have you not?
Yeah.
Okay, so what is it about those kinds of experiences that makes you think, well, they still might be part of myself somehow and not independent? I'm really curious, because I'm going to just say, for the sake of argument, we've had similar experiences on this score, and we're interpreting it differently, and I'm kind of curious why.
Well, I do lean towards that they're independent. I guess I'm trying as much as possible to stick to the truth of what might be going on. And I've made the mistake in the past, I think, of maybe assuming too much, or of taking too much of a leap of faith in terms of what's going on. And that was because, I suppose, I was much more influenced by esoteric ideas and reading about different spiritual hierarchies and things like that early on when I was starting along the path with all of this kind of work. Especially with the first teacher I ever worked with, really, when I was around 15, was a guy who was very His name was Douglas Baker. He was very involved in theosophy, the teachings of Alice Bailey, and all of these particular esoteric ideas. And that influenced me quite strongly for a long time. But then there were certain things that I started to realise were not consistent with my own experiences in what was being described by him and also within some of the esoteric literature. So there was a point where I had to say, well, maybe the science will give me more of an understanding. And I started to not take on science as a body, as a dogma, as an ideology, but more the process. I started to look at truth as my guide, if you like, rather than as my sort of ultimate destination. So I don't try to say this is the truth, I've worked out the truth. I try to say, well, actually, let's try to be as truthful and as honest and as balanced as we can in the learning process, and keep the open mind, keep the possibilities of what's going on. Because I think it's very, very difficult to really say 100% one way or the other. But like I say, I lean towards that they are independent in some way, but that doesn't lead me to the conclusion that there's a spiritual hierarchy or that necessarily any of the religions are correct or anything like that. It just...
Let me get in here for just a second on the subject of hierarchies. I used that term because it's convenient and I think it's approximately correct for the situation, but I don't mean it in the rigid sense of, for instance, your Catholic Church. You've got your popes and bishops and cardinals and priests and so on. They all occupy very specific stations that they're not allowed to move outside of, whereas I look at the spiritual hierarchy as something that's more a matter of a cooperative mutual interest, where if one spirit is in a position to do something for or with another spirit, it will take on the role that is most appropriate for that situation. And that may put I'm just going to call it that individual, into a position that hierarchically appears to be superior because it betrays a greater knowledge of the situation at hand. So that's all I mean by hierarchy.
Sure. And well, I guess I was using it in the context of maybe again this idea of a top-down system, that there would be a god at the top and then there would be some configuration of entities coming down and towards the physical. That's common in a lot of different religious ideologies, so I'm kind of referring to that. Maybe I don't feel comfortable to jump to that conclusion from the fact that an entity might seem independent. I don't think that's enough to make that jump for me personally.
Well, you know, I have a question for you about that. But first, I do want to clarify that although on the one hand I seem to mute my definition of hierarchy for the sake of conversation because I was talking about the difference between my individuality during an out-of-body experience and that of something that comes across as a spirit guide within the same experience. But when you introduced God into the conversation, then I do subscribe to that version of a hierarchy. So I would put God above all these things. So I'm just saying that for the sake of clarification. But it seems to me that if you've had as many out-of-body experiences as I think you've had from the conversations we've had and the books you've written, and also this conversation is giving me the impression that we've had roughly similar experiences, at least in some places, it seems to me that you've most likely had dreams that include God as well, or that have touched on the idea of God, or who God is, what God is real, that kind of thing. And I'm wondering what your reaction is to that, or even if you maybe didn't have those kinds of dreams, or, I'm sorry, out-of-body experiences.
I've had what is very similar to the descriptions in near-death experiences, a boundless light, a oneness, an interconnection, a sense of being everything and everywhere at once, an overriding sense of compassion towards all life. If that's God, then yes. If that's not God, then no.
I've had the same feeling of love and compassion for everyone, this universal knowledge kind of sensation is highly vivid and hyper-real. But I do not associate that with any concept of God at all. I just associate that with that's what things are like when you're freed of your body, when you're not limited to this prison that you occupy for a time while this body is living and animate. I consider that just to be a natural consequence of not being in that state. And I actually have had dreams, very powerful ones, where I literally have seen God, not a light, although he does have a very strong aura, but literally he's got a shape and it is kind of human. It's just that it's very tall and he has this amazing aura, and there's no doubt in my mind at all, none, that this is really truly God. Now, whether this is what he really looks like, or whether it really is God, that's a different story. But as far as whether I'm convinced or not, yes, I am. But now, this could be a delusion, I suppose. It doesn't feel that way. But on the other hand, because of that, I can say, yes, I've seen God in a dream, at least as far as my ability to identify this being as anything. That's exactly who he is. There's no question about it. And then I'll have spirits talk about God, or angels talk about God, and they will say things about him. Normally, these are non-veridical types of situations. They're information that, on a philosophical point of view, makes sense. And on that level, the information has value, but not veridical. I have had a couple, though, that really are veridical, and unfortunately, it's really irritating to me, because it means that I now have highly veridical examples. In these experiences, the spirit guide is telling me, you're asleep. I'm here to give you a message. This message has to do with God, so that you can trust the message. Here's something that's going to happen in the future. I'm going to show it to you so you know that you can trust me on this other stuff. And then the thing that he shows me, in this particular case, I'm thinking about a dream I had that showed me the Boxing Day tsunami about a couple weeks before it happened. So then it puts me in the situation of wondering, all right, so here's this guy who comes to me, tells me I'm dreaming, which I was, tells me that we're both outside of our body, which I'll assume is true, says, I'll show you some future event, which he did, and I was able to verify it later, and then says, this is so that you know that this other stuff I'm telling you, which cannot be verified physically, is also true. So what am I supposed to make of that? Have you had anything like this at all?
Not exactly like that. Not where an entity or whatever has tried to prove particular statements in that way, no. Again, I would still probably keep the possibility open still that was a framework that I was using in order for that information to come through. I couldn't, in all honesty, be totally convinced by that, I think. It would have to be maybe, for the God idea, I guess we'd have to get back into this whole idea of seeing God in nature, seeing human. Again, I suppose we need to define what we mean by God as well, because we're not, you know, we're sort of assuming, it seems, some kind of Judeo-Christian interpretation of a God here. But
well, on that point, the way he's looked to me in my dream certainly fits the form that famous Italian painters have applied to him. I think that the Judaic-Christian tradition has made an effort to come up with an idea of what he looks like physically. And because of that, about the only idea anyone has of what God might look like comes from that tradition, because there's a long history of artists who have tried to come up with some kind of visual simulacrum for what he looks like. Most religions don't bother to do that. They just say it's God, and God is formless, God is ageless, and has no physical properties that would allow you to put a shape to him. And the funny thing is that even within the Christian tradition and the Judaic one, there are comments about these qualities that he has as well, which would mean to me that all of these ideas of an actual physical appearance are kind of meaningless, other than as a way to identify the being with whom one is conversing or in the presence of. And so as far as I'm concerned, this appearance is secondary to the very powerful, overwhelming knowledge of who it is. Speaking of which, when you're in an out-of-body experience, speaking of vividity and strength of experience, I would imagine that you've had hyper-real experiences, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So if during one of those hyper-real experiences where you are just positive that everything is just vivid to a degree, you might even have thought during the experience, wow, when I'm awake, that is like falling asleep in comparison, right? Have you had that experience?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Now, the thing is that if you identify something in this dream, like, well, that's my friend Rick or something, you would have a tendency to feel pretty confident of that identification, would you not?
Yeah.
Okay. And normally, if you were to compare your ability to verify the parts of your dream or your out-of-body experience, I'm sorry, I'm using my terminology, I should be using yours, you would find, I would imagine, that the ones where you were most confident were the ones that were the easiest to verify. Is that correct?
I'm not sure it's the realism of the experience that tells me whether it's going to be veridical or not. That's a very hard thing to describe, actually. I think it's often in something of the independence of the information. Because, for example, a remote viewing could be very very veridical, but there's something in the quality of it, not necessarily how vivid it is, but just in the quality of it that tends to suggest whether it's going to be veridical or not. It's a very hard thing to nail down, I think, but it's not necessarily related to how intensely real the experience is.
Let me get into that just for a second here. You mentioned one thing, which is independence, and actually that is a factor I use in determining whether something is valid or not, because if I'm giving information within the experience, I tend to discount it as being my own thoughts, and they're not a genuine part of the external aspects of the experience. And if I'm getting information that is independent of me, like if I walk into a situation, I see something and I say, oh, that's a hole in the ground, and the other person says, no, it isn't, that's a shadow cast by this big round thing over your head, I tend to trust what the person tells me from the dream as opposed to what I thought it was when I was in the dream. Have you found the same thing yourself?
Well, as I said, I don't really have guides appearing much within the context of OBEs.
I'm not calling it a guide here. This is just a participant.
Well, even a participant. I tend to just experience within that context people who are unaware of me, usually, because I'm essentially in an out-of-body state. So generally they're unaware of me. So I don't generally have people experiencing the IBE with me.
Have you had the experience of people who are simultaneously aware and not aware of you? That is to say, they can be engaged with someone in conversation physically, and you're witnessing this conversation, and you try to communicate with them, and then they'll respond to you at the same time telepathically.
I've had instances where someone has become aware of me or sensed a presence, some kind of shadowy form, that kind of thing.
Do you mean to say that when you're out of the experience and you go contact that person and you say, you know, it was in this out-of-body state and I saw you and you're doing this, and they say, well, you know what, I saw this shadowy presence. Is that what you're talking about?
Roughly, yeah.
Okay. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about and this has happened to me, this is where it's coming from, okay? So, like, for instance, I had this out-of-body experience where I was watching this person I know, a guy named Dr. David Ryback, who wrote a book on precognitive dreams, as he was in Atlanta, Georgia, having a conversation with a man who had shared, not office space with him, but had an office in the same building he did. And he was focused on that conversation, but I asked him some questions while he was talking to the other guy, and then he answered me correctly without stopping his conversation with the other person and without ever really becoming consciously aware of me. And so when I went to verify the dream, he was able to verify all of the elements that had to do with what I saw occurring between him and this other man, but the communication with me went right over his head. That was not something he could verify. So have you ever sensed this conscious, unconscious, dual communication at all?
Not that I can think of. Usually it's just been that they've sensed some kind of presence or actually been frightened or alarmed in some way by my presence because they haven't known who or what I was. Essentially, so that's it's not been where I've actually communicated with the person that they haven't been aware of or anything like that. Not that I can think of at this moment, anyway.
Okay, now I've got another question on that. In my case, I've had three occasions, and only three that I know of, anyway, where I have been seen somewhere else at the same time as I was dreaming about being in that place. To me, that's a real proper out-of-body experience, because then you've got another body proof that you're out, right? So this happened with the girl I mentioned before named Lisa, my mother and my uncle. But the thing is, it happened a couple times, and it seems to me that may be like a intensification of what is happening anyway during an out-of-body experience. That is to say that it is actually what's happening, it's just that most people don't notice that you're there. But if they had the ability, they would see you. So in my mind, that kind of thing tends to verify the idea that you're physically in a different place. What do you think of that? And have you had that experience yourself? Because it sounds like you've, at the very least, come close, or people have had a sensation of you being there, but have you actually had people see you, literally see you?
What do you mean, in like fully recognizably?
Yes, yes. They're awake and they actually see you and they think it's really you in the room and they wonder how you got there.
No, it's been more of a like a shadow form or an impression, like a ghost or something like that.
Is it something that they're seeing, or is it something that mentally...
Seeing, yeah. Seeing.
Okay.
But not not as in where they thought I was physically in the room.
Okay.
I know that does take place, but it seems extremely rare.
Now, what do you think about the idea that kind of experience tends to validate the notion that an out-of-body experience literally is a body leaving a body to go somewhere else physically, as opposed to a mere shift of mental focus, for instance, as would be the case with telepathy or remote viewing?
I think the factor that's maybe kept me thinking that maybe it's more an extended or a projection of consciousness in some form is the clothing factor. For example, one of my first students, she had an experience with her boyfriend where he's quite skeptical actually and doesn't really believe in anything like this, but he saw her in the context that we're talking about, where she looked like she was physically in the room, and he was able to see even down to what she was wearing. And that was verified. He described what she was wearing, and it was accurate to what she was wearing on that day. Now, the interesting thing to me with that is, well, you know, if it is just some kind of spirit body or energy body, why would the clothes match? That seems a bit strange to me. Why would you be wearing clothes? I can't discount the energy body from that totally, but it's an example of where I think the idea that you're projecting an image of yourself or an understanding of yourself and the other person is picking up on that might account for that more satisfactorily than just saying that it's some kind of energy replica that happens to be wearing clothes as well.
I can understand the logic behind that and find it compelling. But on the other hand, I also think that it makes just as much sense to say that let's just assume you are projecting an actual astral body, for instance. Your astral body has left your physical body and it's gone someplace else. You're seeing something. This is how you get the vertical information, etc. And perhaps for your own comfort or because you're accustomed to thinking of yourself dressed and clothed, and because your mental body is susceptible to your thoughts, it automatically just has clothes on. In the same way that ghosts have a tendency to appear younger and more vibrant and in a state that the person who is seeing them is most likely to recognize them. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to a degree, but then at the same time, if it's so susceptible, if the body is so susceptible to consciousness that it's actually creating an outfit and dressing your form, then why couldn't the entire form be a creation of consciousness as well?
Well, it could be either way, actually. Do you think it matters?
Not hugely, but it's an interesting area to explore, because obviously the standard line in astral projection literature is that you have one, two, multiple bodies which are connected by a silver cord and that kind of idea. As I've gone through the process, I've come to the conclusion more and more that doesn't really stack up as a good explanation for what's going on. And it could be that there's some form of body, but I only experience a body in a very small proportion of experiences now. Whereas early on, I used to experience a body more, but as time's gone on, and as I've actually moved further and the experiences have expanded, the idea of a body has sort of dissolved away, and it's become much more of a traveling awareness, a point of awareness, things like that. So this idea of a body seems to have become less and less prevalent in my experiences.
Silver cord. I've never seen one.
No.
In any of my out-of-body experiences. Have you?
Never.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to put it... Let's just
and that's
that
consistent
there.
With... I lost count of how many students I've worked with, but over the last 25 years, I've only come across the silver cord in very, very rare circumstances.
Well, since you just talked about all of these students, can you give some idea numerically what the proportion would be out of, say, 100 students?
Maybe, yeah, in 100, maybe one or two people will describe a silver cord. Unless they've been through a particular kind of training with a particular person or organization who emphasizes a silver cord, in which case I think that's sort of been planted in there as an idea. But if they're coming as just people who don't have preconceptions or anything like that about a silver cord, then generally they won't experience it. It won't even come up, actually, in most of my sessions with people. It's very rare.
Let me ask you this. I'm just going to give you an example from my own experience right now, and I could see if you've had something similar. Some time ago, long, long time ago, and it might even be the first ones in my records like this, I went to sleep, and then all of a sudden, this very famous Swami named Swami Satchidananda appeared in my dream and he said, you know, it's time for me to show you how to leave your body. And then he just started to pull me out of my body. And it was this really thrilling sensation. Thrilling, I think, is probably the best word for it. Very, very exciting. And then he, as I got all excited about the idea of leaving my body, he said, you know, maybe it's not time yet. And then he let me go and I woke up, right? But a couple weeks later, he showed up in another dream. He says, okay, let's try this again. And then I went with him and a bunch of other students and had this out-of-body experience. And then I started seeing these spirit guides near me when I'd feel this vibration and then I'd wake up and I'd be lying in bed and they'd be helping me out of my body. And then when I came back from one of these experiences, there'd usually be like a spirit who had been with my body the whole time while I was away, and then they'll help me get back into my body. Have you ever run across that at all?
Like I say, I mean, the idea of maybe some kind of guide or in a dream context, I've had lucid dreams where a figure has appeared and given me some kind of instruction, and that figure, that being within the dream has seemed very different to normal dream type characters, if you like. And that's often information has come through that's led me to the conclusion that, you know, that it was accessing some kind of wider information. I've from the age of around 4 or 5, I saw an apparition standing in the hallway of the apartment I grew up in. So that's been there with me longer than the OBEs, really.
I want to ask you something about the apparition in the doorway, because I frequently, just before I wake up, will dream of apparitions in my doorway. Like, I become really conscious that I'm sleeping in bed. I feel my body in my bed. I see my room. And there's an apparition either in my doorway, it's somebody that I know is a ghost, or, like, right over my bed looking at me. And if it's near my bed, usually it's a spirit guide. And if it's in the doorway, for some reason, it's not. It seems to be either a ghost that I don't know, or it's somebody I do know but who is alive. Usually somebody who's sick, like a friend of mine who has AIDS. I saw this way in the doorway once. And I'm just kind of wondering if there's something about doorways, because I've read about this elsewhere also, that people see these ghosts just standing in a doorway looking at them.
Yeah.
And sounds like you've had that as well.
It didn't
right?
move. It stayed on the spot, just staring.
Yeah, that's the
doorway.
Same here. Why do you suppose that is?
No idea.
But it does happen. And
you can just theorize that maybe it's because it's a traditional place that you move from one place to the next, or, you know, there's usually movement through a doorway or something like that. We associate it with the division between the inside and the outside, something along those lines. That's all I can... all I can offer on that as a possibility. But
by the way, I was just kind of curious, because the thing is it is a common type of experience, something that, you know, if people didn't communicate with each other and compare notes, you might not recognize as being all that common. I'll ask you another one. And actually, it's happened in this conversation a couple of times, is that I've asked you things assuming that because I've experienced it, you have also. And in fact, you have, as you said. The mere fact that I can make assumptions like that, I think, says something about the veracity of these kinds of what other people would call anecdotes, or these kinds of experiences, is that why would I be able to assume correctly that you would have had experiences that are either identical in character or very similar in character to the ones I'm having? It seems to me that if there were no common factor, that is to say, if there were no objectively real quality to it of some kind, whether it is a misfired switch in the brain or something that is more spiritually related, I don't think that would happen. But another thing I was going to ask you about is, have you ever had out-of-body experiences where you encounter ghosts? And question number two, related to the first one, that have tried to interact with you?
I guess the big question there is to know whether they were actually alive or dead. I've had beings that I've seen, and on rare occasions where I've interacted in some form, but to know whether they were actually dead or alive, inverted commas, you know, whether they were still physically living or not, I couldn't really say. My experiences with afterlife levels where I'm more certain that's what was going on was one experience where I saw a group of a lot of people, maybe 150 people, something like that. I don't know exactly. In a sort of misty environment. This was like on another level, not on the sort of physical level. It was like I'd gone to this other level, and then I saw this large group. They all seemed distressed or confused. Maybe confused is a better word, not distressed, but they were confused by where they were and what was going on. And I got this sense that they'd passed very quickly and very recently. Then after the experience, I was able to find that actually there'd been a large plane crash basically that correlated very well with what I'd seen. So I don't know for a fact that that was what I was seeing, that I was seeing the people who'd passed from that crash, but that's what it seemed to be.
Yeah, you've just brought up something that I was kind of hoping that would happen in this conversation, and that is that we've just introduced after-death communications into out-of-body experiences, which is something that I find, at least by my classification of these things, is very common. That if you're out-of-body, you are quite likely to run into others who are likewise out-of-body, and that you would pay attention to them, and they would pay attention to you, or they would guide you in one way or another. Whether they're, properly speaking, what we describe as a spirit guide is irrelevant in this context. Do you feel that is the case, that if there are ghosts about, whether of living or dead, that you are likely to run into them during an out-of-body experience?
I wouldn't say for me it's likely, no. Afterlife levels, I think some people may be more mediumistic and attuned to that level more. I think in my personal experiences, it's more... It doesn't seem to operate on that level quite so much. It seems more of a maybe moving in sort of this kind of reality, this level, and other levels, but not so much the afterlife level.
So it sounds to me like you're saying that when you have an out-of-body experience, you are really literally looking at a physical environment, that you stay with the physical environment during the experience. Is that right?
Not always, no. I do go to other levels as well. Not ones that I would characterize as the afterlife levels very often. That's a rarer experience.
How about a combination of the two? Because, like, for instance, it looks like our physical environment, but you have these characters that, so far as you can tell, are, properly speaking, they're ghosts of some kind or another, whether they're somebody else having an OOB or if it's someone who's actually passed on.
No, it's rare that I will encounter someone who's also out of the body in any way, dead or alive.
When you say rare, does that mean it has happened?
It has happened, yeah.
Okay.
But again, like I said, I couldn't say whether they were dead or alive. The encounters I've had, it hasn't got to the point where I've been able to identify who the person was or whether they were dead or alive. That's the problem I've got in answering that question, I guess. I don't know enough about the individuals to really say.
Well, you know, that's actually a problem I run into also. I keep all these records and I'm able to verify a certain quantity of these things, and that's nice, but this kind of event normally can't be verified at all, because you need to know who the person is in order to check up
exactly,
on it, usually.
Yeah.
How do you feel about considering those to be valid or objective experiences if you can't verify them? Do you feel like, well, I'm going to just have to... I'll have to discount that thing entirely, or do you feel like they may actually well be valid because they match characteristics of other things that you were able to verify?
Yeah, I don't discount anything totally, and I usually try to, actually in my out-of-body experiences more these days, I'm kind of aware of if there's an opportunity for verifying it, like a Christmas tree incident couple of years ago, where I went over the main square here in Tallinn and saw them hoisting the Christmas tree into place for the, you know, the decorations for Christmas, and in the experience I instantly thought, wow, this is something that's very, very obvious and dramatic and something that I can verify. So sometimes in the experience, I'm very conscious of that.
Okay. Yeah, I've actually had, you know what, actually, let me ask you something about this. I've had experiences where, like, for instance, get back to the same guy I mentioned earlier, Dr. Richard Breeden, because he's figured in a number of my out-of-body experiences. I've got two that involve him that were very strong on my end, and he absolutely denies that anything like them happened. And yet I've got all these other ones with him that were even less vivid in many respects that he is able to verify. That and the funny thing about it is that I felt so strongly about the ones that I can't verify that even though I won't put this in print or I won't make the claim in print that they are verified, because obviously they haven't been, so I can't do that. But I still feel like I'm right and he's wrong, and he just might not be remembering the incident properly. Have you ever run into something like that? And would you be inclined to do the same thing, or would you actually say, no, it's wrong, I'm wrong. My friend says it didn't happen, that's the end of the story.
I wouldn't necessarily say it's the end of the story. The things that I can't fully verify, like if I wasn't able to get a name or I wasn't able to, verify it with the individual, I might just make a note of it, put it on the kind of undecided pile. I wouldn't discount something totally in terms of an OBE, because as it seems with you as well, I mean, my OBEs have generally been veridical and have had evidence that I could gain from them. And I think that's an important factor with all this, because some people have said that out-of-body experiences aren't veridical, and that they're possibly happening in some other alternate reality that doesn't have the same features as this one, etc. And although I think there are obviously other levels that it could be happening on, I think often veridical elements do come through, and that's true in the near-death experience as well. You know, Janice Holden found 92% of the cases she looked at, which was all the published cases, were veridical. So I think all the way along the line, it seems to me that these experiences do demonstrate that. It's just, I think the factor has been there hasn't been any research done on them since the 60s, really, virtually nothing. That they've historically been hard to control in a laboratory setting.
Actually, just for the sake of people on this Skeptico forum and other listeners who maybe don't participate in the forum, I wouldn't mind hearing you address the difficulty of pursuing this kind of research. And I'll start that just because that way I can just let you just say whatever you like, and I'll have this out of the way. But in my experience, I've only been able to, like, direct myself to a certain person on, I think, two occasions, maybe three. And in each one of those cases, it was because that person had a need for me to be there that I knew of, and I prayed that I be allowed to go there so that I could help that person. And on those very, very rare occasions, it actually worked. But otherwise, I just go to, it seems to me, basically random locations. I have no control over it whatsoever. How about you?
It sounds like I have more control than that. But again, when I do take control of the experience, it often seems to diminish the quality of the experience. So I would imagine that, for example, in the Robert Munro experiments that were done back in the 60s by Charles Tart, I would imagine that the problem that he faced during that process was A, having to induce the experience within a particular time frame, within a particular context, and then also having to gain specific information that was maybe outside of what his particular conscious awareness was picking up. I think there's often an assumption that signs, pictures, things of that nature will be the best targets for these kinds of experiments. And interestingly, I can't really think of an instance where anyone has really described a sign or a picture.
Oh, actually, that has happened once, and I think it was Charles Tart who talked about it. It's probably a famous case because it's the
Miss,
only one
Miss
like
Z.
It.
You're
yes,
talking
exactly,
about the Miss Z experiment.
Number. But that's probably the only one like it.
It's the only one in the literature, but the problem with the Miss Z experiment is there does seem to be a high likelihood that she could have cheated in some way. So, you know, the sign was in the same room. It was observable from a certain position. And, you know, it seems, I don't know. I can't dismiss it totally, but it seems kind of, it doesn't seem like a hugely strong case. We can
put it. You know what? I'm glad you said that. And the reason is because, I'm convinced of the out-of-body experience phenomenon because it's happened to me. I'm convinced that they can be veridical because I know it, because it's happened to me, okay?
Yeah.
So when I talk to someone and they make a claim that they've had an out-of-body experience and it was veridical, I'm not inclined to immediately think they're tricking me somehow or they're trying to pass off something that's not true as true. And this carries forward into my reading as well. So I do take I wouldn't say an open-minded view, but a generous view of what I'm reading until I get to the point where I feel like I've read something that is dissonant and doesn't make sense, okay? And that would obviously have to be that it doesn't make sense according to my understanding of such things, whatever they are. And the thing that has always bugged me about that Ms. Zed story, and I didn't really notice it until just now, even though I talk about it every once in a while, is that it's really weird to have an experiment of the number on a shelf variety work. It just, that never made sense to me. I'm like, why? Why would this one person and this one experiment be the only time that kind of experiment ever worked? It just never occurred to me that I should question that. I mean, it bothered me that it is unusual. And I've certainly had nothing like that happen to me, and I haven't read about anybody else either. But, you know, now that you mention it, it bothers me a lot more.
Well, I guess the problem for me in terms of, you know, the perceptual side of it, the idea of her seeing a five-digit number in order and being able to remember it clearly whilst out of the body and coming back... from my experiences, that seems just kind of unlikely. I've had the most information in terms of text or numbers, that kind of thing, has been a postcode. The first veridical experience I ever had was I picked up a postcode while I was traveling to the location. So I saw W11, which was on a sign, which in London you get these white signs with the postcode, the area code of where you are. So as I was moving along the street, I saw the W11, but I couldn't make out the street. I couldn't, the street name would be on the same sign. It would be on the same white square, but I only picked up the W11. Why? I don't know, but this is kind of the thing of how it works. And then the second factor in the same experience was I went into the first floor of a terraced house on which I now know was Lancaster Road, but at the time I didn't know that. But I just went into this house, looked down at the desk, and I was able to pick up just the name. Again, I could get the name of the person who lived there from, it was letterhead paper. This is going back to sort of pre-computing, really, pre-internet times. You know, we're talking, this must have been about 92, something like that. I was able to get the name, so I'd got the W11 and the name, but I couldn't read the rest of the address. So it was like the information that I could pick up was fragmentary, and that seems to be how these experiences pan out with most people that I've talked to.
Well, just for the record, it's exactly like that with me too. I find remembering text to be really difficult to do. I've been able to do it. It sounds maybe a little bit more easily than you, because I have remembered it from time to time and in greater quantities than what you're describing to me. But it's unusual and it's very difficult. Like for instance, I've had a number of these fairly strong dreams that where these ghosts come to me that purport to have been friends of mine in a previous life. Pardon me for introducing reincarnation, but And in this life, they refer to me by a certain name. And I've been able to pick up Mr. Geschen, which is spelled G-E-S-C-H-E-N, which is a German name. But they've actually used my full name in those dreams. And I just, for the life of me, haven't been able to remember the rest of it. And they've given me full addresses as well, and I haven't remembered those. Telephone numbers I've been given in dreams, and I've remembered just parts of them, not the whole thing. But yeah, that actually really bothers me about Tart. In fact, you know, not Tart, but that particular witness. Have you had the experience that you've been listening to someone talk about their out-of-body experience or their telepathic experience or after-death communication or something like that, and it just, there's something about it that felt off-kilter to you? Like for me, when I listen to these materialization seances, for instance, with Madame Blavatsky and things like that, those bother me because they just don't sound right. So I've become very suspicious. How about you?
Oh, yeah, I'm very suspicious about a lot of the early turn of the last century kind of materialisms and physical mediumship and those kinds of things. I think there's very little reason to suppose that they were real, to be honest. I feel that a lot of it was faked, and there's definite solid evidence that a lot of it was faked. So I don't know. I mean, and there's even a whole question mark over the Fox sisters, you know, because they admitted cheating, but then they went back on it again later on.
Not they, plural, one of them singular. I think it was Margaret Fox who was the one who admitted it, and then she recanted.
Yeah.
Okay. But what kinds of things make you suspicious anyway? I mean, is it when it is not consonant with your own experience, or what is it?
I think it's when it's not consistent with my own experience, but also not consistent with what's been found in parapsychology over the last 130 years. I think when you have people who are claiming psychical abilities that go way beyond anything that has ever been done in terms of labs and research and things like that, I think it's very hard to balance that out, and especially when it doesn't conform with what I've actually experienced as well. Like we've just agreed, these things are scratchy and fragmentary at best in terms of the information that comes through at certain times. So when someone comes along and says that on a regular basis they're picking up detailed information, names, telephone numbers, addresses, that kind of level of information, it just rings to me of not being honest.
Now, I'll give you another example. And this has to do with psychokinesis. I've had a number of what you would call spontaneous PK experiences in my life. I normally don't bother recording these because I'm kind of militant about my dream book being a dream book and not a book for anything else to be put into. And for some reason, I never... Well, I think it's because, these waking experiences, that, like the PK things that I just briefly described as happening, are so rare that it's not worth making a book, because it'd take me 50 years to fill it with fill half the page or something like that. But I get very suspicious of PK incidents, even though they happen to me. But the reason is because when they happen to me, they're really unexpected. It's not because I'm trying. And in fact, any time I've ever tried to make it happen, and a couple times I have, it doesn't work. But the spontaneous experiences, there is always a real need for it to occur. And that's where I suddenly get really curious about other people's accounts, is that when I don't see that there's a need for it, or if it seems like it's gratuitous, or that it's a self-gratifying kind of an effect, where like you'll read about somebody making lots of money in casinos, that kind of thing, it's almost like I've got a lie detector inside that's telling me no, this is all wrong, because it just doesn't work that way. Have you reacted kind of in a similar way to PK stories?
Yeah, for sure. I think PK is one of those areas that's as you say, probably even more elusive and harder to control than any of the other psychic abilities, really. If it even exists at all. I've had experiences that have seemed to be PK, but again, can you be 100% sure that object or that often it with me it's been electrical things There's...
Well, I can tell you, I'll tell you just very, very briefly. In my case, there's no question it has to be PK, either that or I've got some amazing hallucinations that have been shared by other people. But this one time I was playing backgammon with my wife when I just had like, it was almost like I could hear a voice in my head saying, if you say we will now roll matching descending doubles from sixes to ones, it will happen. And then I thought, well, shoot, that's kind of an interesting idea. What's the harm, right? So I said it, and it actually happened. My wife rolled double sixes, I rolled double sixes, double fives, double fours, threes, threes, twos, twos. And then after the second pair of twos went down, which is 20 rolls in a row matching that prediction, I felt really weird about the whole thing, because this is before I really fully accepted Psi, and it was kind of scary, actually, too, because I knew mathematically what I'd just seen was completely implausible. So I said, we're not going to get the ones, and we didn't. But the thing is that that's something that my wife and I both saw. And you know, we were both wide awake and made the prediction before it all happened. It was very clear. So if that had happened to you, I think that would fall outside of the category of, I can't really say that's PK. Is that right?
No, actually, I would still... say that it could have been a precognition of a really unlikely event, and
yes,
and it could have just been a really unlikely coincidence. I mean, I would probably say that it seems like some kind of PK for sure, but there's still other possibilities. You know, I don't know that I would say that it couldn't have been anything else. You know, that's a big jump again, you know.
Okay. Well, look, I said I was going to wrap it up, and I didn't do it very well. So let me ask you one last question. It has nothing to do with this other stuff, probably, but I always like to give a plug for eating right. I saw on your site that you're a vegetarian, is that right?
Vegan, yeah.
What do you know? I'm vegan, too. I've been vegan since I was 18, which is 1984. How long have you been vegan for, just out of here?
Measuring up. I turned vegetarian when I was 16. Uh-huh. But I've only been vegan for about 7.5 years.
Okay, well, you're younger than I am, though, right? Aren't you? You're like in your 30s.
Yeah,
okay.
I am.
Well, yeah, it's kind of funny. When I became vegan, I it was almost immediately after I became vegetarian, because what happened is I stopped eating meat, but I continued eating yogurt and drinking milk and eating cheese, that kind of thing. I never liked eggs, so that was never a part of my diet, but... almost as soon as I became vegetarian, I couldn't stand any of those other things anymore. So within 6 months of becoming vegetarian, I became vegan, but I didn't know that there was a word for that diet. I thought I was still vegetarian, but when I was in England on a trip, I was asking for some food, and the girl behind the counter said, "Oh, you're vegan then?" And I said, "No, I'm from America." And she's like, no, I mean, the food you're asking for is vegan. And I was like, "Oh, okay, fine, I'm vegan." But at around that time, I met this guy, and I was told he's been vegan for 18 years. He's 36, so he's been vegan since he was 18. And I was like, oh, I can't catch up, because he's already older than me. But, you know, I have. It's just that I had to wait until I was the same age, because we both started at the same age. So you started before.
Well, it's interesting, because you said you don't drink as well, and I don't drink either. Yeah. So we're both vegan, don't drink.
And don't take drugs. You know, actually, I wanted to say that, because I mentioned my fairies, and you've mentioned a couple of things that probably sound pretty ludicrous to some people. And I want to make it really clear that sometimes when you hear stories like that, you might think, oh, well, that sounds like you've been taking LSD, or you've been smoking marijuana, or drinking too much. But the thing is that, and I'm just going to say this for the record, you can say whatever you like afterwards, but I've had like four sips of beer in my life, all of which happened before I was about 15, when I got that mixed up for root beer, and then I stopped drinking it. But I just don't drink alcohol, and the only couple times I've had it happen are, I can count on my hand, and they were all when I was a little kid and I was around people who were drinking alcohol. Then I've never taken any drugs of any kind outside of aspirin and you know, whatever my doctor gives me for whatever reason, and that's rare. And I am vegan. I've been vegan for most of my life. And it sounds to me like that also describes you. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, very, very close. I've never taken any drug outside of, just things like aspirin and whatever as well. My whole life, never taken anything. And I've never drunk alcohol at any point in my life either. Just tasted it when I was a very small child, but that's it. So, yeah, I've been... drug and alcohol free and vegetarian since I was 16, vegan for about 8 years, 7.5, 8 years.
Well, okay, now actually, and you've also done yoga, as I have, right?
Yeah, I used to assist in teaching it at one point, and I've done a lot of meditation and practice in that area as well.
Okay, now one thing I'm going to say about that, I've had people ask me, do you think that you have these experiences because of the yoga? And I can honestly say no, because I've had the experiences since I was a child prior to starting the yoga. However, I do think it is not outside the realm of possibility that I took yoga on because of, say, an unconscious prodding in that direction that may be related to these kinds of experiences. What do you think of that?
Sure, yeah. I suppose with me, I made a conscious choice to move in that direction because I found the teacher that I mentioned earlier when I was, you know, only around 14, 15 years old. And I think he saw the potential in me from the beginning. So he got me working for him straight away. And I was working, selling books and generally helping with his lectures and his workshops and things like that from the very beginning. So I was already being influenced towards various spiritual practices and doing yoga and those kinds of things. And, you know, he was influencing me in a positive way, I'd say, from that point. So that's kind of how it happened for me, I guess.
In my case, it's a little bit different in that I was very materialistic as a youngster. All I wanted was money, money, money. And I had a very pillage and plunder kind of an attitude towards what I wanted my future to be like. I actually wanted my future to involve me becoming some kind of industrial tycoon where I could put widows and orphans out of their house so I could take them over and make fantastic wild profits while being completely amoral. That is to say, never doing anything illegal, but doing everything possible to make the most profit for me, which I have to say, I look back on my notions of what I would like to be as an adult, and I in horror right now. I look back at that and I think, oh my gosh,
who it was sounds that? Pretty horrific.
Yeah, but I remember. I mean, I used to have these crazy fantasies about just having piles of money and being completely indifferent to the suffering of others. And I mean, literally, that was part of the fantasy. It wasn't just that I wanted to be rich; it's that I wanted to be able to, like do things that would be considered not very nice to other people. Like, for instance, put them out of their houses, but to do it in a completely legal way, so there's nothing wrong with it. And yet, morally, it would be considered quite suspect. And I just look back on that, I'm like, where the heck did that come from? Because it's just not who I am now. So, you know, you had your spirit, your teacher who led you on this path. I didn't have anybody like that. What happened to me was, while I still had this very anti-religious, anti-God, and a very material outlook on life, I had already become vegan at that point. But not because I wanted to be a more spiritual person or because I loved animals. I do love animals, but that's not why. It was because I don't like to eat anything else. I never did. I always liked only fruits, vegetables, and grains. It's just that I always had the adults around me forcing meat down my throat. So
I used to become almost physically sick when I was given meat. I used to heave as if I was going to vomit when I was eating meat. So it was very natural to become vegetarian as soon as I had the independence in my...
Actually, one other note. Have you found that you've had critics? They'll talk to you about these experiences of yours, and they'll say, well, now, that's the kind of thing I would expect from somebody with long hair who probably has taken drugs when he was younger or something like that. Without knowing anything about you, they'll just immediately make this assumption, and then you will find out later that although you've never done it, they have.
Actually, very few people do bring up drugs, but they're usually happy when I do bring it up and say that I haven't actually taken any. But yeah, they often seem to be thinking that, and I'll often just offer it up because it's kind of obvious that they might be thinking it. But I think often people are maybe too polite to actually say it generally.
I've had a couple people mention it to me, and others, just as you say, they seem to be thinking it. So I'll just go ahead and I'll put it out there. But But the thing that surprises me is that in every single occasion that this has occurred, or on every single occasion this has occurred, the person in question has always tried drugs themselves. So in every case, the person who is suspicious of me is a person who's done it, and I'm not. So you've never, have you checked that?
Yeah. I mean, they're nearly always in exactly the same. Yeah, it's nearly always someone who's used them quite a lot. But then again, I think people who haven't used them are quite rare. So, or at least in my experience growing up in working class London, anyway.
Yeah, well, I agree with you there. Well, look, I think we've had a very nice long chat, Graham. I really appreciate your time, by the way. Thanks a lot for talking with me like this.
Well, thank you, too.
For Skeptica. Oh, no problem. Are there any parting words you'd like to give to the Skeptica audience before we go?
No, I think we've kind of covered everything. Just, you know, if anyone wants to get in touch or, you know, clarify anything we've discussed, I'm happy. Yeah, GrahamNichols.com. That's Nichols with two L's. They can just Google me, and yeah, if they want to be in touch or anything like that, or look at the research I'm doing and any of that kind of stuff, there's quite a lot of information on the website.